during the last 2 years. And the main aim of this and other projects has been to find an example where we can make a connection between microscopic description of gravity and some effective dynamics at long length scales. So this is something that any theory of gravity should address at some point, because it's the effective dynamics that we observe around us. But in general, this is a very hard thing to accomplish. Now, I will show that in a particular toy model of causal dynamical triangulations in 2+1 dimensions, we have certain observables for which we can explicitly perform this program of connecting the bare microscopic theory to the effective action. So as an introduction, given any path integral formulation of gravity, what can we do with it? And in particular, how do we determine its effective dynamics? Ultimately, the only consistent way of doing this by identifying observables on your microscopic geometries and giving them some interpretation in terms of continuum metrics. This is true, in a sense, in any path integral formulation of gravity. But in CDT, we're constantly reminded of this fact due to the nature of the model. We can feed this model into a computer and require the computer to perform measurements on this. And measurements in CDT are really algorithms that we feed the computer that assign numbers in a consistent way to configurations. And in that sense, the measurements are always observables and in the other direction. So the only thing we can do is for measurements, and the measurements will automatically be observables in the sense of the triangulations. So the difficult part is to find a subset of all these possible microscopic observables we have on the triangulations and give them some continuum interpretation. So in the last 10 years, the success story has been for the observables where they measured the spatial volumes, and a lot of interesting results have been derived. But it's notoriously difficult to go actually beyond this observable. So especially the degrees of freedom in gravity that that measure the shape of space and are believed to be the true degrees of freedom, they are the hardest to probe. So the challenges we face when attempting to do such a thing are summarized on this slide. And well, of course, the first thing you have to do is you have to construct observables that measure some aspect of the macroscopic shape of a triangulation in this case. Now, when you go to researchers working in the field of medical imaging or computer graphics, they tell you that this is a hard thing to do. In fact, they have whole journals dedicated to the area of shape recognition, which is a certain aspect of observables that measure shape. Now, in quantum gravity, the situation is quite a bit more complicated than it is there, because our geometries of, say, random triangulations are far wilder than the ones encountered in, say, medical imaging and computer graphics. And one of the reasons for that is that in, say, CDT, we expect fractal behaviors on short distance scales. So we really have to make sure that the things we measure are the long distance regime in the geometries. So suppose we have such observables, then to be able to connect that to the effective description, we have to construct a class of effective action that might describe our theory. And for each single one of them, we have to determine what predictions they make for the outcomes of these experiments. And then, when we have this path integral, we should determine boundary conditions on the path integral that maximize the information contained in the measurements of these observables. And finally, one has to match measurements in the microscopic theory to the effective action, and that's the way one can make connections. Now, in general, this is all these four points that I describe here involve a lot of non-trivial steps. But I will show that in the particular case of causal dynamical triangulations in 2 plus 1 dimensions, where we take the topology of the space to be that of the torus, that we can explicitly go through all these four steps and actually derive non-trivial facts about the effect of dynamics. So the outline of the talk, I'll give a brief introduction to CDT in 2 plus 1 dimensions and recall some results that were previously derived for spherical topology. Then I'll briefly describe what I mean by an effective action for CDT, and I'll construct a class of possible effective actions. Then I'll introduce the observable for which I'm going to try and construct this connection between the microscopics and the macroscopics. And I'll show some data and how we can compare that. Then I'll show what new options this leads and the connections to other microscopic theories. So causal dynamical triangulation is introduced as a regularization of the Euclidean path integral for geometries. So what we do is we restrict the full path integral to geometries that are triangulations. And these triangulations, T, are built from equilateral tetrahedra. And we sum here over the inequivalent ways that we can put them together. Now, the causal in CDT means that we restrict these triangulations to have a foliated structure where at every incident time, we have a 2D triangulation. And finally, the action we take is the Einstein-Hilbert action evaluated on this piecewise linear manifold. And it gives us the most general action that is linear in the numbers of simplices of different dimensions. So for measurements on these, one can use Monte Carlo simulation in the standard way, where we first restrict the partition function to a fixed three volume, and the action then simply reduces to something linear in a number of vertices in the triangulation. And one can introduce observables in the standard way. And using Monte Carlo techniques, we can numerically evaluate these observables by starting with some triangulation that fits our boundary conditions, and by performing a large number of so-called Monte Carlo moves, which satisfy a certain detailed balance condition, ensuring that the triangulation we end up with is uniformly sampled from the Boltzmann distribution up here. So what do we mean by an effective action for a certain set of observables in such theory? Well, suppose I define a set of observables Fi, which assign numbers to triangulations. Then I can kind of trivially rewrite the partition function as an integral over the observables, and then an effective action here, which is simply the logarithm of the number of inequivalent triangulations weighted by this factor having those values for the observables. Okay. We can continue. So the goal is really to determine what this function is and to see whether this. So The goal is to see whether the effective action appearing here in the exponent, when taking a set of observables that more or less describes the continuum degrees of freedom in the metric, whether that that effective action has anything to do with, say, Einstein-Hilbert action or another gravitational action that we know of. Now, the way we can learn about this effective action is by measuring expectation values of these observables and correlations, and perhaps even higher order correlations. And what has been done previously is measuring spatial volumes. So we take for these set of observables the spatial volume at a certain time t. And this has been done in the topology where we have a periodic time s1 cross spatial topology s2. The result that one obtains for such a configuration is that the total number of spatial triangles condenses into a finite interval on the time axis. And the expectation value of the volume is well described by a cosine squared term, which precisely the spatial volume you get for a three-sphere foliated by constant proper time surfaces. Now, this configuration is well described by an effective action of this form. And it turns out that the correlations as well are very well described by such an action. So we can compare this action to the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action. And what we see is that the Einstein-Hilbert action evaluated on the spherical cosmology gives something of the same form. But there is an important difference, namely that there is a minus sign in front of the full action. And the consequence of this is that the effective action is bounded from below, while the Einstein-Hilbert action is not. So this is a generic feature of Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action, namely that it's unbounded from below. And the easiest way to see this is by writing the metric in a proper time form, in which the kinetic term is given by the Wheeler-DeWitt metric of this form. And this Wheeler-DeWitt metric is indefinite on the space of metrics, meaning that there are deformations of the metric that are negative, and those are the conformal directions in superspace, while the traceless directions, which are kind of the physical ones, they are positive definite. Now, this is an obstruction to having Einstein-Hilbert action as an effective action for a statistical system. Recall that we identify this partition function with an integral over the spatial volumes, for instance, weighted by this action. Now, this thing can only make sense if the effective action really has a minimum around its classical solutions. Otherwise, it would never give the measurements that we actually perform for the correlations and the expectation values of the spatial volume. So we have to take a step back and see what alternative ansatz we can write down for CDT. And there are two guiding principles here, and they have to do with the kind of geometries that appear in the path integral. So first of all, the CDT triangulations have a fixed distance between the initial and final boundary. And this is unlike the variational principle in GR, where the distance between the boundaries is a property of the classical solution. Now, what does this mean for the possible effective actions? Well, it means that we have to restrict the effective action to a subclass of all continuous geometries. And the continuous geometries that have a fixed distance between the boundaries are roughly those that can be written in an ADM form with lap set equal to 1 and having fixed values for the time at the boundaries. Now, this also means that the classical solutions of this effective action will not have an effective equation of motion of the form, the variation with respect to the lapse. And therefore, we cannot expect an effective Hamiltonian constraint. And this also means a priori that an additional local scalar degree of freedom is expected to pop up, and we can identify this one as the conformal factor. Now, a second consequence. Perhaps. Okay, so a priori, it seems unlikely that GR will appear as an effective action as is. In some way, the additional degree of freedom should disappear at some point if GR is to come out. And it seems unlikely that that is going to happen in the usual sense. In the end, I'll try and make some connections with conformal description of gravity, where the degree of freedom can drop out without having the spatial foliation, the change in foliation symmetry that we have in GR. But in any theory where there is a preferred foliation, a priori you expect local degrees of freedom to pop up. And that is also the problem that has been encountered in Hoshava-Lifshitz kind of theories. So, as in Hoshava-Lifshitz gravity, it is natural to extend the symmetry group or to restrict the symmetry group of the effective action to those that preserve the foliation. So what then happens is that the Einstein-Hilbert action generalizes to an action where we can have a kinetic term given by the most general ultra-local supermetric on two-dimensional geometries in which there is an additional parameter freedom. Now, this parameter lambda, if we take it smaller than 1/2, then we have positive definite metric, which is something that we look for, while Einstein-Hilbert action corresponds to a value of lambda equal 1. So I will argue that not only for lambda equal 1, but also for lambda approaching 1/2 or equal to 1/2, these additional degrees of freedom may drop out. But anyway, if we take lambda smaller than 1/2, then we have a positive definite effective action, or an ansatz for that, at least as far as the kinetic term is concerned. So then we can attempt to compare this to the data from the simulations.
Index the curvature. I mean, from Hoshava-Lifshitz, it's unitarity, so that's why it didn't happen. In your case, a priori you can have a general function of excessive curvature, and there is no reason it should be bounded in degree. Or do you have an argument?
I mean, so I have arguments why no higher derivative, time derivatives can pop up, which is due to the fact that a CDT configurations have only interactions between consecutive spatial geometries.
But that's at the discrete level, but in terms of the effective action, you don't, the effective action might capture some kind of non-local, you know, you don't know that it localizes.
That is true, but I mean, there are always assumptions going in here. I'm definitely not.
So there's an extra assumption.
This is an extra assumption, yes.
But you haven't investigated numerically what happened if, you know, maybe you could get a better fit or a better match with even wider things that are, you know, higher in derivative.
So it hasn't been investigated. I mean, the numerical simulations are, it is always very hard to compare this stuff to to actual Anusatsis. And so going beyond kind of, we can only really probe the lowest order in any respect when we compare these to theory. Deviations from theory haven't been, people have, so then people have also attempted to find kind of deviations from really just the volume profiles, like the ones I shown before, for the spherical topology. And it turns out that the simulations are just not sensitive enough to do that. So we're really looking for an action which is to lowest order describing our system. And once we find some agreement on that level, we can go beyond. But at this point, that is.
Okay. There's still missing an argument why it should be quadratic in terms of the, which would be a good improvement, great improvement. Because then Ravalichi is generic.
Yeah, so here the attempt is to make connection with Shavalichis because they're kind of having the same kind of symmetry groups arising.
But so I would say, yeah, that because Ravalichi is generic, if you assume there's no more than two time derivative, you cannot get anything else but Ravalichi. Right.
Yeah, so
that's again the
assumption that there are two time derivatives.
What?
That is again the assumption that there are.
Yes. So that's the main thing. Once you make this assumption, then you have to make contact with the
Ravalichi. But isn't it? I mean, the intention of an effective action is to extract the terms of lowest order derivatives.
Yeah, but you don't know whether that's the case there.
We don't know, but
so
it's,
that's.
Well, let's see. Let's see what you do with it. But
because my criticism is that if you assume that there's two time derivative, then there cannot be anything but Ravalichi.
Sure.
So the main thing is why the effective action has to be, you know, to assume this local form in this limit.
So there's
no locality.
So if there's some convergence to something with
the
separation scales, then the low energy stuff will be dominated by the fewest number of derivatives. And then you've just made an argument that low energy stuff is either general relativity or Hajjavi Lipschitz.
I think it's more subtle than that.
Even if you just make the assumption that there are these number of derivatives, this is still a non-trivial statement about the effective action of just the limited number of observables. I mean, we'll see that the fits we have to make are they're not generic. We get non-trivial fits from data with the ansatz for Shavalichi's gravity, because the prefactors kind of in more global effective action for a limited number of observables, they depend in a non-trivial way on the spatial geometry. And that is something we can test. And of course, once we've established this correspondence, we can attempt to go beyond this. But yeah, we're really looking for the low energy limit.
Well, that's the question. Maybe you don't know. You have this machine to produce number. It's not clear that there's a low. It's the low energy limit of something. Because if it was, then there would be a derivative expansion, right? You have this machine that produces these numbers. The fact that it's the low energy limit of something, that's essentially what I'm asking. You know, there's no derivation. It's an extra assumption.
It is an assumption, but it's an assumption we're going to test. And we can extract couplings that appear in, say, this ansatz from Shavalichi's gravity. And that would learn.
Okay, my question then, is there anything to test? Because as far as I know, the Lavalier Lipschitz. Lavalier Lipschitz is universal. If you assume two time derivative and spatial
invariants,
then that's it.
So it means the most of the information I'm putting in is in that assumption. But still, it's non-trivial that, say, a model like CBT will give you a geometric theory, which can be described by a metric. I mean, that is an assumption that goes into a Shafer-Lipschitz gravity, that at certain length scales, we can describe the geometry by, well, a spatial metric. And
isn't that built-in in CBT? You have your slice, and there's a large scale, there's an effective shape and metric.
Well, that's what we hope.
So,
but
it's evolving. Well, there's always an effective metric in each slice, right?
I don't agree.
So where is the...
I mean, if you have fractal behavior on a certain length scale, then that essentially means that there is not an effective geometry that governs all the dynamics at that scale.
Okay. So if once you establish that you're not in the fractal region, which...
So we establish that we're at a start in a certain system scale, system size, we get beyond this region if the data fits for Shafer-Lipschitz. Mm-hmm. If it does not fit this, then it means that it's still fractal at a certain scale, and well, then we either give up or try to increase the system size. And even we actually expect that the current system size, there is still a lot of fractal behavior going on. And I'll actually show an observable later on which characterizes it numerically, and we really need to take that into account when comparing it to this. But I agree that the ansatz of Shafer-Lipschitz gravity is an obvious thing to expect here. And it's really hard to extract non-trivial information from these models because it's already kind of dictated by the symmetries of the system. But that is a lesson that we can also learn from a model like this, that really extracting non-trivial information is even more difficult than just measuring observables and matching them to something. Okay, so to be able to test this ansatz, we need some observable that measures the shape of space, as I already mentioned before. Now, a place where we can do this is when we take the torus topology. So there, every spatial geometry in time has a topology of a torus, and we know that any such geometry is conformally related to a flat one, and the flat ones are described by parallelograms in the upper half plane. So we can assign a moduli parameter to any triangulation of the torus or geometry on the torus, and these are the ones that we can measure in time. So now the question is, what can we measure and what can we learn from these measurements? And first of all, how do we determine them for a triangulation? So let us step back for a moment and see how one can extract them from a continuum metric. So by definition, we can write any, well, not by definition, as I just said, any metric on the torus conformally flat, and we can characterize the flat metrics on the torus, and that means that we can write it as a conformal transformation times this flat metric characterized by the moduli. So how do we determine these coordinates that make this metric flat, conformally flat? So the thing to realize here is that these one forms, which are derivatives of the coordinates, are special and that there are harmonic forms on this geometry. And we can describe them as being annihilated by the Hodge Laplacian, which is constructed from the exterior derivative and the adjoint. So it's the divergence of the exterior derivative with respect to the standard inner product on differential forms. And these two one forms are uniquely determined by requiring them to be dual to a set of generators that run around the torus in two independent directions. And finally, when we have these coordinates and their differentials, we can determine tau by evaluating the inner products of them and plug them into this simple formula. Now, the reason why I've described this algorithm in this way is that the differential forms are objects that can be naturally extended to discrete geometries given by triangulations. So the recipe is as follows. We have to determine a pair of curves that generate the fundamental group, and we have to determine the kernel of the Laplacian on one forms, and then determine a basis for that that is dual to the curves, and finally we can plug them into this formula for the moduli. So the ingredients we need for this are the discrete differential forms, which have been introduced in the theory of simplicial complexes already quite some time ago. And once we have those ingredients, we can perform constructions as here, where we find by numerical linear algebra techniques a concrete embedding, a specific embedding of the triangulation into the Euclidean plane, and we can extract the moduli corresponding to this embedding by the formula given here. Now, I'll not go into detail about these discrete linear algebra constructions. The idea is that a discrete differential form is a function that assigns to a p-simplex a number, and one can derive or one can define linear maps on these discrete, these finite dimensional spaces of differential forms. And you can define them, the exterior derivative and the divergent, which is simply the adjoint of the exterior derivative with respect to an inner product. So using discrete differential forms, the Laplacian becomes simply a matrix, which the dimension is a number of symplices of a certain dimension. And by using numerical linear algebra, we can construct a basis for a kernel of this matrix, and we can use that to determine tau. Now, the non-trivial boundary conditions we need to get a non-trivial evolution of the moduli in time, they have to be taken special care of here, because if we perform CDT simulations with topology of the torus in periodic time, then we don't see the symmetry breaking that occurred in the spherical case. And there are several ways to overcome this problem. So one can insert sources for the spatial volume in the simulations, and one can also put in twisted boundary conditions when we're using periodic boundaries. So in the spherical case, what you get is that when you take a time-independent kind of CDT configuration and run the simulation, then all the simplices will condense into some finite interval in time. And therefore, it breaks the time translation symmetry of the system. If we do this for a spatial topology of the torus, we don't see such a behavior. So we can measure kind of expectation values of observables there, but what we will get is just the same number for every step in time, and there is little to learn from this about the effective dynamics. Yeah. But it does change, but the expectation values don't change. Because there is still this time translation symmetry, which...
But you still see, I'm confused. You still see some dynamics on the tau T? I mean, each slice has a tau?
Each slice has a tau, and they're correlated in some way. But if I'm interested, say, in the classical solution of the effective action, then I look at the expectation values of them.
Expectation values affect to what's in interval of time?
The expectation value of the observable tau at time t in the ensemble. So in order for such a expectation value to have a non-trivial time dependence, I really need some breaking of this translational symmetry. And we don't observe this for standard boundary conditions.
I don't understand why. Because suppose you start from something and then you let it evolve for some time, so you have a kind of average dynamics. Then you follow what tau t is doing, and it has a dynamics there.
No, but this is periodic in imaginary time.
We keep track. I mean, the system in the computer is the full space-time geometry, and that evolves in computer time, and we track the values of these observables in this computer time and take averages over them. But these averages for different instances, for different spatial geometries in our configuration, don't show any non-trivial time dependence.
But the taking it periodic in imaginary time is the same thing, of course, as a thermal ensemble. So that you're just saying that the ensemble is good.
True.
I mean, so you could. Why do you do periodic boundary conditions?
So I'm not doing periodic boundary conditions. I mean, in CDT on the sphere. This is a natural thing to do because you do get the symmetry breaking, and you don't have to worry about any boundary conditions at all. It chooses basically its own boundary conditions, having an initial singularity and a final singularity. So on the sphere, they would get more or less the same result if they would just take the initial boundary to be, say, a single point. The final boundary is single point, zero volume. It's just a matter of a convenience in the simulation. The point is here that we do have to take some non-trivial boundary conditions to get some non-trivial evolution of the quantities that we're measuring. And so what we do is we want to put in fixed boundaries. But we don't want to put in kind of nice geometries that we constructed by hand, because that could lead to some bias in the space-time geometry close to that boundary. Since we don't know what the generic spatial CDT geometries look like, we don't want to put in these geometries by hand. What we can do is we can restrict these boundaries to be degenerate geometries, and in this case, the useful thing to do is to take them to be ring-shaped singularities. So, topology the 2+1 dimensional topology we're going to investigate is the one which is given by the complement of the Hopf link in the 3-sphere. So here I've depicted the 3-sphere as 2 3-balls, of which we've identified the points on the boundary mirror-wise. And the initial singularity here is the axis of the balls. And the final singularity is given by the it's living on the boundary. And well, it's depicted twice because those points are identified. And foliation is the Hopf foliation, which of which the generating curves, one of them contracts to zero when you go to the initial singularity, and the other one contracts to zero when you approach the final singularity. In this way, we ensure that the shape of the spatial geometries changes significantly from initial times to late time. In particular, the moduli corresponding to these geometries start at torus zero and end at torus I infinity. And showing these in the Poincaré disk, we can depict a single CDT configuration as a path connecting 2 points on the boundaries. And any geometry in between corresponds to a value of the moduli. And that corresponds to a certain shape of the torus. So it's these values that we can measure for any configuration in the ensemble. And we can determine their expectation values and correlations. So here I'm just flashing some of the data we get just to show that there is a lot of data coming out of these simulations. So we have the expectation values for the volumes at different instances in time, and the expectation values of the moduli at different instances in time, and their correlations. Now the problem is where to start comparing this to the effect of action. Now it turns out that a certain data contained in this whole bunch can be directly related to the kinetic term of the effect of action. And that is the change in slope at the diagonal of the correlators, of the correlation functions. The plane is t prime, so different times. So here I'm plotting. Yeah, I'm sorry, it's a bit small. It is the expectation value of tau 1, of tau at time t times tau at time t prime. So that characterizes the correlation of the shape of the torus at different instances in time in my CDT universe. Sorry? Yes, sure. So it's the jump going from tau at t times tau at t plus 1 to going to tau t squared and tau at t plus 1 times tau t. That is the other way around. Yeah, tau.
Do you mind just trying? Can you I can see any labels.
Can you use the blackboard?
Yeah, of course.
And just say what all these graphs are.
On the left
here. So these ones, these are the expectation values of the volume, time t.
Times t?
At time t.
At time t. And on the horizontal axis is time t.
Yes.
Okay, so this is the universe that expands and contracts.
Yes.
Okay, that's clear. What's the second one?
This is the expectation value of the real part of tau in the Poincaré disk as a function of t. So it evolves from the initial singularity, which is on the boundary at minus 1, to the final singularity at 1.
Okay. And what are the yellow points?
So this figure is the correlation fiat t and fiat t prime. So these
and where t and t prime are the two axes?
Yes, there are two horizontal axes and vertical ones correlation. So this is the same replacing phi by tau 1.
Right.
This is for so, tau 2.
Okay. So maybe here you can answer my question about whether it's quadratic. Looking at these things, you can tell whether what's the best fit. Right? Because this is the raw data.
Yeah, I mean.
So now you can say, maybe, you know, you can tell whether it's, it could be non-local in time or not.
True. I mean, of course. I mean, I can take the full matrix correlators and take the inverse of this matrix, and that gives me roughly the second order variation of the effective action around the classical solution. And that gives me, to great accuracy, a second order derivative in time, which implies a kinetic term with two time derivatives. But I'll get to that in a second. So that's the thing I want to extract from here. So just to make sure that we know what to compare to, I can evaluate my effective action on a homogeneous cosmology, and that gives me a mean superspace action of this form. Now, it turns out that this is not the most useful thing to compare to, because this prefactor in front of the tau dot squared term depends sensitively on the choice of this flat spatial geometry. We can do better by not taking into account homogeneity and deriving the prefactor for general spatial geometry. And what appears there is this object, which is the expected change in the moduli under a normalized metric deformation, whereby normalized, I mean normalized with respect to the Wheeler-DeWitt metric. So this is the general outcome of the ansatz, where we do not take into account any flatness or non-fractal behavior of the geometry. So for a geometry in conformal gauge, we can evaluate this object explicitly, and what you get is an integral of the inverse conformal factors. Well, we can rewrite this in terms of the original metric, but the important thing is that it's larger or equal to 1 over the volume. And it's equal to 1 over the volume precisely when the geometry is flat. Now, if we can measure this on the triangulation, and what we get is that for a regular triangulation of the torus, this quantity is exactly equal to 1 over the volume. So let me introduce exactly what the definition is on the triangulation. So the natural discretization of this object is a sum over all triangles of the area of this triangle in the conformal embedding in the plane. So measuring this thing, so here I depict a slightly more inhomogeneous triangulation, which has a value of V times A, which is already quite a bit above 1. But for a more typical geometry in CDT, the V times A can become of orders of magnitude larger than 1. So this is really something that we have to take into account when considering the effective action, that the geometries appearing there are not flat in a good approximation. So we have these three quantities,
yeah.
No, true. So the two is a pure traceless degree of freedom. So and it also does not appear in this quantity.
Yeah. Is that an approximation or it's
no, this is general. I mean, the nice thing about this quantity is that it has a real interpretation in terms of the triangulation. It is really measuring kind of how much the moduli parameter changes of this triangulation when we perform a random flip of, say, one edge in this triangulation. So if the triangulation is really flat, then the moduli doesn't change much if I do a small update. But if the triangulation is wild and we have kind of these large, small conformal factor triangles, then the moduli of the triangulation can change much more as compared to the regular triangulation. Now we have these objects, so tau, the volume, and A that we can measure, and our effective action relates them to each other. So first here, what I plot is 1 over A as a function of time for several different boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are basically just the lengths of the singularities. K0, that's the coupling in the CDT action. Now, as already mentioned, these correlations, they are proportional to the inverse of the effective action to second order in the variations in tau, meaning that we can reconstruct from measuring the correlations in tau and the correlations in V the relative prefactor in the kinetic term. And that is this 1/2 minus lambda times A. So I can plot the data for that in the same graph where the only freedom of fitting the data is an overall scaling in these graphs together. And what we see is that these curves coming from the correlations of tau and phi sit nicely on top of the theory curves. Not the theory curves, the measurements of A directly. So a byproduct of this is that we also get a direct measurement of lambda, if we assume that the Rojava-Lifshitz ansatz is valid there. So this is a direct test of the kinetic term together with a determination of the coupling in the Rojava-Lifshitz action. Now, I can do this for various values of K naught, which is the CDT coupling.
And therefore, and you measure an average value for the relative prefactor.
True. So this is kind of neglecting the fluctuations in A.
But also, you showed that your simulations have a strong time dependence.
Yeah. So that's also reflected in the time dependence of A. So I've measured A at a certain spatial geometry at time t, and that is what is plotted here.
Again, it's hard to read the plots.
So this is 1 over A as a function of time.
Okay, and it goes sort of from 20 to 127. So 1 over A is very small. So A is very small. 1 over A is large.
Yeah. I mean, A times V should be of the order 1, where V is the number of triangles.
Okay.
So the numbers on the vertical axis are of the order of the number of triangles at each time step.
Okay.
but they are strictly smaller than that because of the fractal nature. So as a function of the CDT coupling, which is coupling in the bearer action, we can determine the coupling in the effective action. And what we see is that when we approach the phase transition in CDT, that the effective coupling approaches 1/2 from below. So remember that lambda smaller than 1/2 was the region where the effective action is positive definite. And when we are at lambda, the kinetic term for the conformal degrees of freedom drops out. So this is for a fixed volume. So we've traded the K3 dependence for a fixed volume. In 2+1, yeah, I mean, the phase diagram is simple in the sense that we can use the K3 to enlarge the volume. And we expect kind of the geometrical degrees of freedom only to depend on this non-trivial coupling.
So you're saying you get evidence that the critical point is just conformal.
Yes. So a similar result and similar dependence of lambda on K0 has been obtained for CT configurations with a fixed boundary. So there we can look at the fluctuation of the metric close to the boundary. And that is also a pro with the kinetic term. Now, what is interesting here is to kind of look at this region where it's close to lambda is 1/2. Because it might be that the local degrees of freedom, which correspond to the conformal factors, that they decouple at the phase transition, while the traceless degrees of freedom remain coupled between consecutive slices. And this is similar to the continuum description of, say, shape dynamics in 2+1 dimensions, where the symmetry group is also that of the conformal transformations and where you have a preferred time foliation. Now, the hope is that close to the phase transition, where the coupling between consecutive geometries is really weak, that we can make use of properties of two-dimensional gravity, where the conformal properties have been studied well and a lot of analytical techniques are available. So just to summarize, in general, connecting microscopic gravity to effective dynamics involves a large number of non-trivial steps, which I've tried to illustrate in this explicit example, where we can actually do them. And what we find is that if we compare this to, say, Orshava-Lifshitz gravity, that the kinetic term and the parameter appearing in that can actually be deduced from measurements. And we also see that the fact that the symmetry groups of CDT and Orshava-Lifshitz gravity are so much alike is confirmed by the fact that the Orshava-Lifshitz action describes our data for the moduli well. So some outlook. I would like to extend.
What would be more convincing is to have a more general action and show that the best fit is the one where these extra parameters vanish. Right? So, I mean, here you find only what you look under the lamppost. Right? You put Orshava-Lifshitz gravity, so the only thing you can find is Orshava-Lifshitz. The best would be to really compare that to other possibilities.
So the trouble is that, well, as you said before, this Rajavalichik gravity seems to be just the kind of the simplest action you can write down, having the right properties here. So any kind of more, any other action will be some deviation from this.
Yeah, but from your case, the usual argument of Rajavalichik doesn't matter. You have tau 1, tau 2, and V, and you can write any type of dynamics in there. With
true, so
more than just one parameter. It could be an arbitrary number of parameters there. And then, or you know, maybe three or four. One for V, one for tau 1, one for tau 2, and then with different, and then one for tau 1, tau 2, or whatever is going on. And then, you know, let's say four parameters, and seeing that, you know, when they all are equal to the one, which is, it matches up. That the best fit is really on this. We should check that, you know, checking your hypothesis that you have effective, you know, DFO symmetry, and that you have effective this, and effective that, and effective ability, right?
But again, these measurements are shown, they're only sensitive to this kinetic term. So any kind of deviation from Rajavalichik at the kinetic term would be a kind of a higher order.
I don't know, because if you suppose AG and you have suppose that T1, T2 term vanish, it would be more convincing if you had this big parameter space, then you would say, well, clearly this extra parameter has to be zero, and this extra parameter has to be equal to that one.
Well, it's just not as simple as that. But, I mean, to give you one example of, I mean, this is not the first one we tried. For instance, this functional A I described here, initially we did not include that in the comparison with the data. So if you put here just simply a V, then and you plot both these curves, then you see that there's no way that they'll match. One of them is far too flat as compared to the other. Now, one could attempt to kind of put in a parameter which goes from simply V to this particular dependence on spatial metric. That's something we have not done. Probably the way to approach this is when we go beyond the kinetic term. So there it's clear that we need also a potential term, which...
I mean, is it clear, for instance, that T1 dot, T2 dot vanish? The coefficient interval?
You mean this whole coefficient
interval? No, you have T1 square plus T2 square, but they could be off diagonal.
Yeah, but okay, so that is not really possible because there must be a modular invariance in this action.
Yeah, from the continued things, but in your case you don't know. That's exactly...
No, but I mean, the measurements are modular invariant. The determination of tau in the simulations, if you would change your generating curves on your torus, that would change exactly the tors by a modular transformation.
But it doesn't tell me that if I don't put alpha to 1 dot to 2 dot, I cannot still fit the things with this alpha and 0.
Okay, but I mean, we always put in some information into the effective action to reflect symmetries of the microscopic theory. So invariance is already present at the microscopic level.
What you would like to show is that the symmetry is effectively present. So you do the numerical things, and then you measure these off-diagonal terms, and you find that the best fit is when this breaking term vanish, which would be evidence in favor of the symmetry rate plus 2.
So, okay, I mean, there's always a matter of priorities here. And symmetries of which you already know that they're present at the microscopic level, well, to actually show again that they're present at the effective level is not a priority at this point. The priority now is really to
obtain an effective action that describes our data, and for that we have to go beyond the kinetic term. And then we can start.
Yeah, but it's unclear to me that, that CDT is different in Mario, because modular in Mario is different. So you're saying, you know, I mean, maybe it's clear to you, but it's not clear to me that,
so
that this is true, that the symmetry is implemented in CDT. So here you're assuming that the symmetry is implemented, but, you know, if I'm skeptical about that, I'd like to see evidence for that. You expect that this is true, but as long as you don't show evidence, you don't know if it's true. Right?
I mean, definitely assumptions go in here. But the fact that these microscopic observables only depend on the geometry of the triangulation is for us reason enough not to investigate this in large scale. And what is more is that we don't expect that the full effective action describing our data is really Orszáva-Lifshitz action, because we're not in the infinite system size regime. So only once we find an effective action that describes our data, we can start increasing our system sizes and see whether terms that don't belong in the action from the Orszáva-Lifshitz point of view drop out or not. And that's where the kind of non-trivial tests will go into. So the connection with shape dynamics, something which is worth pursuing, and also whether there are analytical tools which can help us near a phase transition. Furthermore, we have seen that discrete differential geometry is a natural toolbox to construct observables, and especially large-scale observables, in discrete theories of gravity. And it might be that also in other approaches, like Regge calculus, spin foams, and tensor models, these can lead to useful observables. Finally, having such large-scale observables can help us in constructing coarse graining procedures or renormalization, because the measurement of such observables in should be invariant under coarse graining, because they're really probing the effective regime of the theory. Okay, so thanks for your attention.